I think I remember the first time that I coveted the call to come to St. Paul, Rockford. It was singing that hymn. And it probably was about this time of year, because about this time of year, in Matthew and Luke at least, you will always have texts about "Fear not, little flock." And as a result, "Little flock, fear not the foe" shows up in the recommendations for hymns to be selected and gets selected. And I had not picked the hymns. I didn't begin picking hymns until, well, after I got here, maybe a month after I got here. So I don't know who was doing it at that point, who was using the hymn selection guide or what have you. But again, I was driving, usually on a Saturday afternoon, 4.5 hours up from St. Louis, staying at the De Guzman's, trying to get a little work done before the morning, getting up, driving over here, driving to Central, driving up here, driving home 4.5 hours. It was pretty intense work, let's put it that way. It was a lot of movement for a weekend when I had to go back to work on Monday. In any case, I remember being at Horseman Street very vividly. I remember sitting there getting ready to preach, and I'm pretty sure this was the sermon hymn. It may have been the opening hymn, but I wasn't standing. And in any case, I remember that the hymn being sung. And I remember thinking about, I would have been visiting you for at least a month and a half, maybe 2 solid months by this point. And I remember thinking about what a challenge you had before you. About how, well, nearly impossible the circumstances looked to me as someone from the outside. A financial struggle that was already well underway for a decade, and the numbers that had shrunk, we've talked about this before, so imagine having your pants being 5 sizes too big and you're still trying to run a race in those pants, sort of what you were doing. I remember that. I remember thinking about that often, but also seeing the potential, seeing that you were a people who were hungry for the Word of God, who really cared about each other quite a bit, who wanted to learn why we have the worship that we have. And not as small as you thought you might be once you went from 4 services to 2 services, which the elders decided, again, before you even invited me, but once you did that, and then once you stopped wearing pants that were too big, to actually realize there was a lot of potential here for you, a lot of strengths to build on. So I've been thinking about all that as well, but you get up, pretty early to drive from Belvedere, where the De Guzmans live, over to Central Site. And it's through Rockford, like State Street, the whole way. It is empty, which is weird, right? But it was about a 20-minute drive, 23. But it's empty, but it's Rockford. I mean, it's just full Rockford the whole way. And then you cross over, and I didn't know the faster way on Whitman Bridge yet, so I'd cross over State and go up through downtown and come up kind of through the neighborhoods. And it's even more Rockford, right? And it's, I feel like it was a rainy day. It may have been a day just like this one. I certainly, when I got to church, was sort of like, I gotta do this. It's good. It's what I do for a living. It's what I do because I love it, but I'm not in the mood today. And then this hymn just struck me, right? And it struck me for you, right? For your sake. Here I was at the smaller service, in this older building, in this falling apart city, with all these challenges before you, and these words about how there is nothing to fear hit me and fed my faith. And at that moment, I think I really had the thought, man, I'd love to have this call. Now, a lot went on between then and actually getting this call. We got 6 months, 7 months at least. And I want to say that I made every effort to encourage you to call somebody else, up to and through you doing it once and then even you calling me. But with that said, the desire to be here to tell you this was there back then, in that place down there. And that place certainly served it, fed it, was built to feed it. But it only could feed it insofar as the words were there to be heard. As true as God's own word is true, not earth nor hell's satanic crew against us shall prevail. Their might, a joke, a mere facade. God is with us, and we with God. Our victory cannot fail. That is the promise Christ Church has whenever Christ Church is built upon the foundation of who Jesus is. His work, dying, rising, ascending, returning, his person being the divine one who is also human, the God-man, the new Adam who has broken the powers of sin, death, and the devil. And that's our identity, that we don't just follow Jesus, as I've heard recently said in Rockford by some. We don't even just believe in Jesus, although we do both those things. We are in Jesus. He has put us into him. And he's beaten death already. He has no sin left already. It is, as it said of Abraham, counted to us as full righteousness. There is nothing separating you from that righteousness. You don't see it yet. You don't feel it yet. But it's there. And it's there not just for you individually, but you, plural. And in that regard, no matter what this world might do to us, we're in very good circumstances as a congregation, but if we were not, it wouldn't change what I'm saying. No matter what this world puts us into, our victory cannot fail because Christ has already finished it. It's done. Christ's words in Luke chapter 12 are beautiful, poetic. They draw you to them. I also remember as a young man reading in a book, I believe the book was called Ishmael. It was about a talking gorilla who taught, this is weird, isn't it? He taught philosophy to the zookeeper. So it was a big kind of philosophy book. I don't even know how I found it. It was on a free book thing somewhere. But it had enough actual philosophy in it that as a young 19-year-old, I was really fascinated. What's this going on? What's he saying about life and how things work? And why is he challenging people to change their minds and all this kind of stuff? I don't remember much of what he actually talked about, except for this bit, which is that he talked about this section of the Bible, the flowers and you, the birds and you. And he was very crass. He said Jesus was just waxing poetic. He didn't really mean it. Jesus was just waxing poetic. Of course you have to put your hand to plow and do something. Jesus doesn't mean don't do that. And you're silly and crazy to think that anyone's going to provide for your needs. Now, I think that's a fair comment if there is no God, right? And it's also a bit of a fair comment if you're worshiping a false god. So just any god won't do. A god made of wood and stone, like Baal or Moloch or whatnot, right? He won't do. Zeus, whatever. You pick your poison. Or say, the kind of spirituality that modern Hinduism / the New Age movement / whatever version of it we find in the storefronts downtown would teach you to see that the spiritual universe of the world is going to provide for you, send out your positive, and more positive will come back, right? Same problem. It is waxing poetic at that point. It's meaningless. You're believing in nothing. You're believing in your own flesh. But Jesus isn't saying any of those things. He's not saying believe in nothing. He's not saying believe in this earth. He's saying believe in something that is far beyond and outside of this earth. So much so that it doesn't really care that much about what we see happening to this earth. He is willing to let this earth absolutely go to pot. Completely. He's going to burn it in fire eventually. He's not concerned about stopping all the governments from fighting with each other or stealing from their people. He's not concerned about making every city a growing, thriving marketplace for young adults to move to. He really isn't worried about that. He's not even, God help us, him, not concerned about stopping starvation or disease or any of the other things that we make our primary concerns every day. It's not that he wants us to be in these things because of any kind of malice, but he is the one who sent us into these things as a very fascinating punishment. It's the kind of punishment that's meant to not really be a punishment, right? I mean, you can take someone who killed 15 people on the streets, you can put them in a cell, you can lock the door, you can throw away the key. Okay, that's a punishment, right? That's not what this is. This is more instead, and I don't know that the same analogy will apply, but this is the kind of punishment that you would do to your child. Not because you're angry, will you stop it? Not that kind of punishment. But I can see if my child keeps doing this, where this will go in 10 years. And so I need to find a way now to show my child the consequences of these decisions so that they learn to not make these decisions and, you know, cut their own hand off or what have you. That's what God has done for us. He has shoved us into the wilderness of this valley of the shadow of death with a promise that he's going to sustain us here. He'll provide us the daily bread here, but he's not really so concerned about it being fun. Huh? He's a lot more concerned about us realizing that the cause of this shadow of the valley of death is inside every single one of us. It's not us, it's me. Chief of sinners though I be. Yes, as Paul says. That's what he has put in front of us. And with that, isn't it interesting then how our chief concern, our anxiety, as Jesus calls it, is always about these things. And not about being more able to retain the confidence in his higher things in the midst of these things. Knowing that our anxieties of these things are the greatest threat to our continued faith in Jesus, up to the point where we die in the faith. Knowing that we still, naturally, not against our will, but because of our will, put our trust, fear, hope, love into these lower things. Don't be anxious, he says. That is an emotion that I didn't mention in the list I landed off earlier. That probably is the chief emotion for me in the whole scenario, but that's not fair, too, in that anxiety is the chief emotion for me in every day of my life, I think. I am an anxious human. I don't think I'm unique in this, though. I may be on a further spectrum than you, but something about living in the modern world with all of the information coming through the computers and TVs and whatnot constantly. When you get into a car, I mean, think about it this way. Every time you get into a car, whether you know it or not, you are moving your body into a life-threatening situation. And as a result of that, your body, whether you know it or not, is going to prepare for that life-threatening situation. Kind of like if you were on the tundra, well, you wouldn't be on a tundra, you were in the jungle as a caveman, and you saw a tiger, right? What would you do? Your body would amplify the cortisol levels, you'd get this massive burst of energy, and you would be prepared to run like you've never run before. You're doing that every time you drive, right? We're doing that all the time. And although we've gotten used to it, I can do it, right? What happens is, over the course of lifetimes, that anxiety gradually builds within us. And just becomes something that we're always there with. And we're like, I know what'll fix it, coffee. No, coffee won't fix it, more of the same. Huh? Now, I'm not saying this so that we strive to make some magic pill. I'm not telling you not to drive or drink coffee or any such thing. What I want to amplify is how the anxiety that we feel, whenever we feel it, is ultimately needless in God's sight. He sees it like a little child crying because of the dark. The closet and the boogeyman's going to hurt me. I need a hug, right? That's how he sees us with every threat to this body and life that we have. And that's the whole theme of what he's saying now. He is that father saying, I have you. I've got my arms around you. Nothing is going to ultimately harm you, even the tiger, as he eats you. He can't. Because it's only your body. And while your body is not nothing, it is now not your only body. If you picked up on this yet, this happened when I was teaching last week before at this camp, Confirmation Kids. One of the college students who was the advisor asked me, let's see, how did she get to this? I don't know how she got to it. She asked this amazing question about Jesus being in heaven. Oh, I had said something like, to be human is to have a body. You can't be human without a body. And she said, but if we're going to go to heaven when we die and our bodies are still here, then we won't have bodies, so will we not be human anymore? And I got this huge smile on my face. I said, do the math. You have all the pieces. You know everything to answer this question. You've just never put two and two together. Right now, you have two bodies. One's the one you're walking around in, and the other one's Jesus. You have Jesus' body. You're in Jesus. You eat him regularly, right? There's no division. This isn't small talk or fluffy talk or symbolic talk. It is a reality. So even though this body die, your body's never going to die. You're in Christ. And when he re-raises this body on that last day, it will be raised exclusively with the materials of him, as opposed to the materials of this present age, which is why it will never die again at that point. It's with that certainty, that confidence, that immortality that you have, that Jesus can say, there is nothing to be anxious about. Food, clothing. The birds, watch them go, and yeah, a lot of them die. But they're also cared for and they serve their purpose. How much more will God make sure that is the case for you? Especially if your purpose is not to die, but to live and to look upon the glory of the Lord in the land of the living, as he has sworn to you. And you gotta love verse 25. Dear heavens. I swear, every time I see it, I'm like, I'll read it and then I'll say it. My response is always in my head, right? Which of you, by being anxious, can add a single hour to his span of life? Every time my head goes, I can. I can. I can get 15 minutes, I'm pretty sure. Yeah? All I gotta do is like stop eating this and start doing that, and there you go, I fixed it. Yeah? I always want to rationalize my way through that thing. And his point is really not that point at all, right? His point is that God is in control of it one way or the other. He's hemmed you in on every side. He is allowing your evil to make certain free will decisions. And so certainly you can decide to eat something that's unhealthy or eat something that is healthy. But at the end of the day, it's not like he didn't let you do it, and he doesn't know exactly where it's going to lead and when it's all going to come to an end. And so the anxiety you have over that, rather than a prayerful request that he would simply guide you, and a faithful, trusting request, guide me to the next thing, Lord. Right? That is, in fact, this is the best part, part of the reason you might die earlier than you want to. Because, of course, one of the leading causes of heart attack is stress, which is anxiety. That's why I love this verse. It just destroys me every time. It's a complete condemnation of me. We can't add anything to our lives. His point is that we don't need to. Why would you want to? He's giving it all to you. He has it all planned out. And again, he's not saying don't learn, don't try something, don't do something. That's just tomfoolery to try to say that's what he's saying. He's saying he is in charge. So what's before you with your hands for you to use them to do? Do that. What can you learn that inspires you to help others? Learn that. But the need to fear this age? Needless. Needless. Consider the flowers. Solomon in all his glory. Solomon, if you don't know, I mean, you probably know he's David's son, right? David's son inherits the kingdom. David has ended warfare. There is no more enemy left as a threat to the ark in the temple of God. No other pagan gods and pagan peoples who want to destroy Israel and put their gods in Yahweh, the Lord's place. And Solomon comes into the kingdom. And he has tithing and offerings from all around him, multiple nations, multiple kings. He is rightly called a king of kings. And in this, along with the wisdom he's given, he has given extreme wealth and extreme influence, all this various stuff. So you must imagine then that for the ancient world, when Solomon would walk out into the public in any way, ain't nobody looked like this guy, right? I mean, he had it done. Whatever it is, whatever we're trying to do with the Oscars, and every year where they all parade their little things and wear the stuff that's supposed to be like these $30,000 dresses, all that, whatever that is, Solomon was more than that. So when Jesus says Solomon in all his glory and everything that he could ever achieve as a man, and no man since has ever come close to achieving it, was not as beautiful as a lily. Not as complex or divinely crafted to look at as a lily. It should put in perspective what we wear. Not that what we wear has to be ugly or you should wear uncomfortable clothing or anything like that. But where is the balance? And where is the value? What is a lily for? Well, the Lord would seem to be implying, at the very least, it is to be looked at. What is a human for? Well, with one rare exception called marriage, it's not to be looked at. It's to do. It's to do is what we're for. To do for others is what we're for. God is taking care of the grass. He's taking care of the birds. It is going to burn. But you are much more valuable to him. In verse 28, he calls you, you of little faith. It's a very polite and gentle translation. I would probably translate it, you faithless ones. Or you who have no faith on your own, right? And this is kind of a key part of understanding your Christianity and your spirituality. You have faith. Otherwise, you wouldn't be here. You wouldn't be listening to these words. But you don't have any faith that's yours, as if you made it, as if you built it and caused it. Rather, it was given to you. It was put into you by giving you something to believe, which is worth believing, which also inspires then this faith. So when he calls you, you of little faith, you faithless, he's driving at that inability of yourself to really fix this problem. If it's up to us to stop having anxiety, we're not going to do it. The only thing that can possibly alleviate that anxiety is his promise to you that that won't stop him from helping you. All your anxiety, all your efforts, all that, it will not stop him from saving you from yourself. Fear not, little flock, he says. The world is seeking after everything else. You seek these things. You seek the kingdom. You seek, frankly, the words of Jesus, the washing which has regenerated you to sustain that faith now, and the meal of the body that will never die. Seek those things. And all this bit about what to do with your possessions, what to do with your money bags that would never grow old, they're all about, as you have this body and life and stuff that God has given you now, asking, who's it for? Is it just for me? Is it just for my family? Or is it for everybody that's not me? For everybody else who, whether Christian or not, needs a helping hand? But then, especially those who are not Christians, needs a helping hand that is not afraid to also speak the words of Christ. And then, especially for those who are Christians, knowing the words of Christ is closer than a brother. And so, when in desperate need, should receive it from us, the family. Why would we do that? Because we have no fear. Because as the little flock shepherded by Christ, reigned over by the Master, the Liege, the King of Kings, Jesus, we already know that it is the Father's good pleasure to give us everything. Everything. A kingdom where no thief can steal, where the moth never ruins what you buy, where the treasure is everlasting. And, amazingly, that treasure is already yours. It's already here. Your hands can't touch it, your eyes can't see it, but it has been placed into your heart. And that where your heart is, you may be forever. And where is your heart? Again, in the body of Jesus. In the name of Jesus, amen.